Radio.
Yeah, what's good? Radar Radio, welcome to the neighborhood. Myself, Chucky Online, and Benny Scars. We have Hattie Collins in the house.
Yes, Hattie.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm honored to be here.
Yes.
Yeah, man, it's great. Thank you for having me.
I'm like so happy that you agreed to do this.
No, Hattie. I'm happy to be here. This is, yeah, like one of the rare times the tables are turned. So yes. I feel like I'm in the hot seat.
Yes.
I'm ready for the pressure.
How does it
I'm ready for what you got. I'm nervous. A little bit nervous.
But you know what? Don't be. This is just a conversation amongst friends. Yeah. And you know, I didn't know if you were if you did like sort of do the I don't call it public speaking, but like the interview thing because that's what you do.
Yeah, I think I probably didn't so much until the book came out. Mm. That was kind of the start of me perhaps talking a little bit more and stuff. But yeah, I mean, until then, I've done lots of stuff where I'm talking about music or like, you know, like they call it punditry.
Yeah.
I go on and chat on like One Extra or Radio 1, whatever. But yeah, for me, actually talking about me and my sort of path, whatever, no, this is probably one of the first times properly I've sat down.
Amazing. So like, let's go from the beginning.
All yeah. Right.
Now I know, I've seen you talk about this a little bit, but you've skirted around a lot of things.
All
yeah.
Right.
So Birmingham, it started for
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
All right.
I feel so bad that I've lost my accent.
Do
I'm
you?
All the Brummies out there, I'm very sorry.
Yeah. Can I just say
that you can switch it back on though?
She can.
When I go back home.
But I actually always felt that you was from outside of London anyway. I don't know why. I don't know where I got that from.
I think hopefully I carry that with me.
Yeah.
Because I think it's quite important for people to realise that you don't have to be from London to sort of make your mark on the scene. Mm. So yeah, I'm from Birmingham. I went to a Irish Catholic school. So I was like very Brummy, just a normal school. And then I moved to another school, comprehensive school, but it was kind of a hippie sort of school.
Oh, right.
So it was lots of like, just like lots of hippie kids really, who just spoke quite nicely.
What do you mean like arty, what kind?
Yeah, arty, like arty, there was lots of kids whose parents were like teachers or like, you know, the school before was just normal parents, you know, whatever. And then this was a bit more kind of, I suppose, yeah, like, I guess more middle class, more sort of like, yeah, teachers or politicians. Like, some of them were, like, there was an MP's parent, whatever. But it wasn't posh, it was just more hippie.
Yeah.
And so I guess I just adapted to that kind of tone, really.
And became a hippie yourself.
I just became a hippie. So yeah, I lost my accent when I was about 12-ish.
And what age? Because you came to London via Liverpool, I read.
Yeah, so I went to Liverpool, like John Moores University.
Yeah.
When I was like 19, whatever, and then I probably moved to London when I was about 21.
Okay, cool.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. And I suppose I should probably add, because I feel like I've really like disowned my past there. But around the age of 9 or 10, when I went to this school, not only was it quite like, you know, hippie, there was also like, for some reason, all the kids did acting. It was like a thing that you did.
Yeah,
so to kind
of
fit in, I started to go to this like amateur sort of thing when I was like 9 or 10. At this place called the Midlands Arts Centre, which is under sort of threat from funding right now, so like I hope people find out about the Midlands Arts Centre and support it, because it was an amazing thing for me as a kid. And from there I got sort of talent spotted, if you like, by a thing called the Central Junior Television Workshop, which Mr. Jam was in Nottingham.
Oh, okay.
Or like Samantha Morton, who was like Oscar winning actress or Oscar nominated actress. So basically I started acting. So again, you know, your voice has to be kind of like level so you can
Would you say that was confidence building for you as well?
Like massively, it's had a big part in me in my journalism. Like even today, you know, or interviewing people where things might go wrong, I sort of learned from an early age how to think on my feet,
improvise,
how to freestyle. So yeah, it was a really big, it's a big part of my sort of who I am, I suppose, as a journalist, really, because it's more, I see myself more as kind of like having a chat with people rather than sitting down and like firing questions. So yeah, acting was like pretty integral to who I am today.
So you moved to London as well.
Yeah.
Right. What was it like moving to London, coming from where you had come from? And what was the plan? Like when you got here, what was the plan for you?
I'd studied drama at uni. Mm-hmm. So my plan was to be an actor, an Oscar-winning, LA-residing actor. I was going to make big movies. I was going to be... I don't know if I wanted to be famous, but I wanted to act. Like, I just loved acting. So that was the plan. Things obviously didn't quite go to plan. I think, actually, I wasn't that great an actor.
Okay.
I think, actually, oftentimes, like, within this scene particularly, you know, you read about people saying, all you need is determination and you can make it. And I don't know if that's always true. Sometimes you can be making it in the wrong field, and it's fine to sort of hold your hands up and say, actually, do you know what? I don't think acting is my thing.
It's a really good point, because, you know, and I'm down for positive thinking,
of course,
speaking things into reality, but, you know, things do require do require a level of ability, whether that comes naturally or whether that's something that you've worked at and you've done your 10,000 hours and you've got past the threshold of good enough. Mm. But you're right, like sometimes you're working really hard, but you're just
in the wrong, there's a square peg in the round hole. Yeah. And I didn't realise that until I sort of come out of acting, but now I look back, you know, I'm really glad that I was kind of, if you like, it's probably quite brave at that point, like in my mid-20s, I just burnt, metaphorically speaking, everything.
Yeah.
I remember I was on this clifftop in Portugal, had a few drinks that night, I was with the girls on holiday, and I was just like, this is not what I want to be doing. I don't want to be the person ringing up trying to get jobs, trying to get an agent. Like, I was doing auditions I did an audition for Choice FM.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Where I had to put on a bunny head and dance to the Artful Dodger in front of a room full of people. And the humiliating thing is, I didn't even get that job. So I was like, you know what, this isn't really like...
That might have been the sign.
This isn't really work. Yeah, exactly. That was like the nail in the coffin. Mm. And that was when I decided, you know what, I need to relook at my life and look at what I'm good at and what I knew I wanted to be involved in the arts somehow, but maybe it wasn't about me being in front of camera. Maybe it was a bit about me, behind the camera. So
you was running a acting agency as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I was, so basically I had loads of mates from uni. They set up a theatre company. I moved to London. I was working at a place called the Groucho Club, which is this private members bar, waitress, whatever. And they were like, look, can you give us a hand doing some lighting for a show in Poland? So I went to Poland with them. Mm. And then I ended up basically filling in for one of the actors. So we had this like little sort of theatre company for a minute. And then on the back of that, we set up an acting agency so that we could get ourselves work. So I would pretend to be a woman called Pippa Ford. And so like casting directors for Harry Potter, for example, would ring up our acting agency, which was predominantly kids. We had mostly like kids on the books, but ourselves as well. So they would ring up and they'd be like, oh, tell me about Hattie Collins. And I'd be like, oh, she's a wonderful actress. Yeah, many years of experience. I would try and flag myself roles or auditions.
Yeah.
So anyway, after like a year or two of that, I was like, it's not going to happen. So all of us individually actually in that sort of little crew ended up going off and doing our own thing.
What, at this point, while all this was going on, what was music playing? What kind of role was music playing in your life? What was you listening to?
Music's
what was you
always been, to? I have to thank like my family really, like particularly my older brother and my cousins, because since I was a kid, I'm from a big Irish family, so lots of cousins. Mm. For me, music, and you know, my parents as well, music was just always in the household, whether it was like my cousin listened to a lot of Northern Soul, my brother listened to a lot of punk, my mum listened to a lot of sort of soul, kind of Janis Joplin, Bob Dylan-y type stuff, Bruce Springsteen was my dad. So like, at some point I discovered my own taste in music, and I think at that point, much to my mum's horror, my brother's horror, I really got into like N.W.A. and Snoop.
Okay.
Their horror being more around the fact that obviously it's quite misogynist music, you know what I mean? It wasn't the most woman-friendly music. Yeah. So they were like, oh, you know, you shouldn't listen to that stuff. And I just loved it. I just loved hip-hop.
How did you come to it? Do you remember like
what, I remember, how, why? Well, I went to a comprehensive school in a place called Moseley Comprehensive.
Yeah.
So there was it was a really diverse school. So there was black kids, white kids, Indian kids, and like there was just youth club. So like people would just bring in tunes. Mm. I remember hearing like, I don't know, stuff like LL, Eric B. and Rakim, all that sort of in that sort of period. And then beyond that, when I started to develop my own taste when I was at uni, I would try and shoehorn hip hop into everything I did. So I did my dissertation on the theatre of hip hop.
Okay.
Which was a bit thin, but I did alright, got a good mark for it. Or like we did this thing with Shakespeare, and I was like, oh, we should do like a rap version.
Yeah.
And then we'll like blah, 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 blah. So, and at the same time, because I'd had this family of like record collectors, I was also buying vinyl myself. So because I had a lot of vinyl, I'd have mates be like, oh, we're throwing a party, do you want a DJ? And I'd be like, yeah, yeah. I had a little show on student radio back
then.
So yeah, and then London, so it just continued like throughout my whole time.
Was you buying records in London as well?
Yeah. I was buying records from when I was like, I don't know, 11.
Yeah.
10 or 11. So records, and then obviously CDs.
Yeah.
So like when I was in London, I sort of discovered like, eventually I discovered like Rhythm Division or like Black Market, Uptown. Even HMV, do you know what I mean?
Wherever. I used to buy records from HMV all the time. You just could find a couple of gems in there every once in a while.
Yeah, that was some good stuff. Yeah, so music in that sense, maybe like just very casually. Well, to me, it was casual. I don't guess I realised actually, again now, how important it was to me, because that has been my sort of, my research really.
Yeah.
It's given me such a big, wide breadth to choose from. So I don't know everything about Bob Dylan and stuff like that, but I have a little bit of that from growing up. And then my own sort of like 90s hip hop, noughties hip hop, and R&B, that's my time, you know. Yeah, and then obviously we were in London, so you go to like your garage night or your jungle night, and I was seeing this whole other scene. To me, that was a bit more foreign though, like raving wise. Because in Liverpool, Liverpool didn't really have like a scene like that. You didn't really have like, I mean, maybe it did, maybe more in Manchester, but not in like, you'd have the odd hip hop night.
Yeah, do you know, I'm really curious about that actually. Because I think like growing up in London and like, you know, like the garage scene was massive in London and the jungle scene was huge as well, like especially for me growing up.
Yeah.
But I always thought like, what are they listening to up them sites? Like, are they getting garage? Are they getting jungle? Or is it just really more about
house,
hip hop?
Like, especially in Liverpool, like Cream and clubs like that. It was all house. There was the odd place that I would go to. I'm trying to think of like a couple of names, but it would just be like just a one off sort of night. It wasn't. Unless, I mean, maybe it was going on and I just didn't, it wasn't like I was a student, I just didn't access that world. But like, we would go to the odd blues and stuff in Toxteth, and there would obviously be like a lot more like, you know, like bashment dance hall. But that was, again, that was just like the one off. So I never felt like, definitely didn't feel a part of garage and jungle in that sense at all. I was more connected, I suppose, to like the American hip hop, because to me it was more accessible at that time. I'd listen to Westwood, Tate Westwood. And then I'd go to any shows that
everyone,
I could go to.
Everyone, that was the thing, innit? Yeah. Westwood on Radio 1. Everyone up and down the country was listening to Westwood.
He was a big part of my education as well, definitely.
Yeah, he was massive to mine. Massive to mine.
So you got this historic love of music, and you're standing on this mountain in Portugal.
Literally, twisting my ankle and everything.
So, you know, because it's a pretty bold... Or in fact, it's probably a pretty daunting move to just think, you know what, I put a lot of time, both in terms of like the educational process and also like career-wise, into you know, going quite far down the track here.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a daunting and brave move to say, you know what, gonna draw a line under this and do something else. But it's an even braver move to do that without knowing what you're going into. You know? So where was your head at with the writing at that point? I mean, were you an avid writer anyway? Were you interested in writing? Was that something that was, you know, a passion separately?
Yeah, I think I've always been good at, I wasn't great at school. Like, one thing when I go and talk to like young people and, you know, like do panels and stuff, one point I always make is that, and then not to say that I'm proud of it necessarily, but I've got like 4 GCSEs, 2 A-levels, and then a degree in drama, which, if you know anything about degrees, gets you nothing. So my education, it wasn't like I'm like, I had like this really, you know, impressive like education. I went to like regular schools. When I moved to London, when I moved to London and started to look into the music side, I didn't know anybody in music. So I'd had this interest in writing. I'd had this acting background. But I didn't know anybody, and I didn't necessarily have like, you know, I didn't have an English degree, so why on earth was I choosing to do journalism? It was a bit like, it wasn't really well thought through, to be honest. It was more just like, as I stood on the cliff, it was like, what do I actually love? Well, I know I love music. I know I'm good at writing because, you know, that was like one of the few GCSEs I got, and I've always enjoyed writing. My stepdad was like, he used to write poetry. My mum used to like write and stuff. She went back to her education when she was in her 30s, and she did a lot of stuff around English and writing. So I didn't really know, I just had, it was more a feeling, it was more like an instinct, I think, to just head in that direction. It wasn't very well thought out, because if I'd known, I guess, how hard it is, or it can be, maybe I would have just chosen something else. But the other side of it is like, what else was I going to do? Mm. I'd worked in so many bars, I'd signed on, I'd done all these other jobs, and I didn't want to go and work in an office. So it really just felt like the only option, if that makes sense.
Go on, you go for it.
I was going to say, like, you know, you touched on something there, and it would be good to just like expand on it, because I just think that it's something that I don't know, you know, how young people necessarily today feel about it, but you know, we've all got a lot of pride, social networks and all of that, we're all you know, giving everyone a highlight reel of our life, just all the best parts. But you know, you mentioned signing on there, which is something that I also did when I was probably 19, 20, like I signed on, I got housing benefit, all of that.
Same.
To try to, just because I wasn't living with my mum and I was trying to do music, and it's difficult, do you know what I mean? But, and I always want to let people know it's not a big deal, do you know what I mean? It's like something that you have to do.
It's a small thing almost in some ways. Yeah. Like, when there was a point when I was signing on and getting housing benefit and stuff,
yeah.
And it, you know, I'm not from London, so I didn't have the family support. I couldn't go and stay with my mom or my cousin or uncle, whatever. So it was just, this is what it was. And I didn't have a family that had any sort of, you know, money at all. So I couldn't, like, ask for, like, I remember my mom telling me 20 quid and her saying to me, this is the last 20 quid I'm sending you. And I was like, all right. So, like, signing on actually enabled me to figure out, at that point, I was actually probably in my mid-20s when I signed on for the last time. So it was kind of late on, do you know what I mean? Yeah. It wasn't, but that gave me the opportunity to figure out what I wanted to do and gave me the opportunity to go, I guess we'll kind of come to how I sort of practically got into writing in a second, but basically when I started to research and how I could do it and I was going to move to New York and do an MA, and like that gave me the time, like while I was supposed to be like looking for work, to actually research what I wanted to do and how I was going to do it. So I have no shame in that at all, like, yeah. You know, it's a necessity, and I think it's also really important, like you're saying, people do show the good times and stuff a lot on social media nowadays, and there's a lot of hard times. There was times when I remember like having my last bit of cash and going to buy like a box of Rich Cheese crackers. I was like, I'm gonna just splash out, I've got a quid left, I'm gonna get some Rich Cheese crackers, and I've got the wrong ones, and I was so pissed. I've got the red ones that were just the plain thin with no cheese in the middle. Getting home and being like,
so disheartened.
It's my last.
It's so mad though,
you just
isn't
want to
it?
Just mash like, up the whole room.
Everyone having that go-to food that, like, you know, like I've got like 3 quid.
Yeah.
And this was my.
I'm gonna
diet.
Get me a pop noodle today, and I'm rising out.
I used to get the like, it was like these pasta parcels, and I just used to kill them. That and pasta cereal all
is
the
it,
time.
Yeah. Nah, Jacob, that, it that was the Jacob's was crackers and the cheese. That was my thing, but the cheese was kind of expensive still.
Cheese is harder.
Yeah, cheese was, you know.
Gotta make that one last.
So, you know, that's amazing that you went through that. Like, can you, because I, you know, what I was going to ask you is, which is something that you touched on, you talked about, you know, researching what it was that you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then starting to look at the process of moving to America. Could you explain, like, a little bit in detail.
So when I was 16 and I was with the Central Junior Television Workshop, they for some reason decided to take us to New York to do like an exchange program. So we went over, but for some reason, New York has never got to come back to us, which is a shame. But we went over to New York when I'm in this to show my age, but when it was like the 90s and New York was not the New York that we know now.
Yeah.
It was scary as fuck. We were shitting ourselves the whole 2 weeks, but it was an incredible experience. And from that day, I just knew at some point in my life, I'm going to live in New York. So when I was on the cliff top and I was figuring out what I'm going to do, my mind kept going back to New York, and I was like, I feel like if I just go to New York, if I head to New York, the answers will appear to me. And so I decided to go and do, the only way to go to New York without a green card is to study.
Yeah.
So that's when I started going and researching how I would get to study there. And because I loved hip hop so much, I thought, I'll just do an MA in hip hop. That's what I'll do, which it turns out doesn't exist. But there is an MA in journalism, which certain people whose books I'd read over the years taught on. Like, to me, they're like really famous, but to no one. There's a woman called Trisha Rose. And I was like, oh my God, she teaches on this course. It's amazing. So then when I applied to them, they said, look, it's cost 40 grand a year to do an MA. So obviously I didn't have 40 grand, but they said what you can do is apply for a scholarship.
We need to start uni ASAP.
Yeah, that's
I'll
40 grand.
Yeah, this is back then as well. Is like 2002, so this is probably like, it's probably significantly more than that. But they said but they said to me you can get a scholarship, and if you get a scholarship, the way to get a scholarship is to strengthen your application by like showing that you're already maybe doing a bit of journalism.
Yeah.
So that's literally how I started journalism. It was really to essentially apply for a scholarship for NYU or for Columbia University, because both were in New York. So I started to try and get stuff published, and in the process of trying to get stuff published and getting stuff published, the idea to sort of go to New York somehow just drifted away, because I was like, oh, I've just got a piece published in Hip Hop Connection. Wow. Or like, I've just got.
What was you actually writing about, and how did you go about it?
Initially, what I did, I remember so clearly for my birthday, I got my brother to buy me tickets for Khalees and for Nas.
Mm-hmm.
And I went like on my own, I guess each ticket was a tenner or whatever. I went on my own, and then I reviewed them and I sent them to the NME. I bought the NME. I looked at the editorial at IPC Media.com. Emailed that. Here's a review. And they were like, you know, like, keep writing, but you know, your voice isn't very strong. I've never written a review before. Do you know what I mean? You know what I was doing. So I thought, okay, let me like scale it back a bit. Maybe not aim for the top right now. So I went back a bit. I went to the B-Boy Championships at Brixton. And I met a guy called Africa Islam, who's like one of the sort of founding fathers of hip hop, whatever.
Yeah.
I asked him if I could interview him, and he was like, yeah, cool. I didn't even know how I got into the B-Boy Championships, because I know I was backstage as well, so somehow I just blagged back there anyway, met this guy, interviewed him. He's Ice-T's brother, so I thought this was quite a great story. Emailed Hip Hop Connection in the same way, bought the magazine or looked at it in Smith's, wrote down the email, emailed this guy called Andy at Hip Hop Connection. He was like, we don't really want an interview with Africa Islam, but were you, if you were at the B-Boy Championships, could you do a review? And I was like, yeah, I could do a review. So I reviewed it. They were like, great, we'll publish it. I don't even know if I got paid, or maybe I got 20 quid or 25 quid. And with that, I went to a magazine called Touch and said to them, oh, I write for Hip Hop Connection. And they were like, oh, funnily enough, we're looking for a reviews editor. Send us some reviews. So I went into town, spent my last 20 quid. I was still signing on at this point. Spent my last 20 quid on, I don't know, 3 or 4 12-inches from, I think it was Uptown, and reviewed those tracks, sent them to Touch. They were like, yeah, do you want to be our music editor or staff writer or something? And I got 35 quid a week, but I was like, yeah, I'll go in. So
yeah, that must have felt all right.
Still. Yeah, so I was still signing on, because it was literally 35 quid a week. So, yeah.
Can I just say so on some one thing that you just mentioned, yeah, because I think you just use a terminology that like, I wouldn't be too much aware of as not being a journalist, You mentioned your voice not being big enough. What does that mean?
So like when I was growing up, I used to read a lot of Vibe magazine and XXL, and you would get to know certain writers even before seeing their names. I'd be like, this has to be Dream Hampton, or this is Bell Hooks, because their style of writing was so defined. So when I sent those initial reviews to the NME, it was probably along the lines of like, Khalees played this song and then she played that song. Like it wouldn't really be, it would have no flavour.
Okay.
Basically voice is like your vibe, your flavour, your style. Yeah. So I had to develop that over time. And when I read back on old pieces now, I'm like, oh my God, it's so cringe. You know, but you know, you learn, don't you? And even I could probably do that from a year ago. I probably read stuff and think, oh, that's crap. But you're always learning and you're always progressing.
I guess it's funny you say that, because even like, you know, when you're reading stuff, or even for me, when I'm reading articles, like if it's got character, then I have a voice in my head of how it is being said.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I guess if it's just really plain and basic, then it's very difficult.
I think my sort of thing is, I think I don't know how I've done this. And I don't know who I've learned this from, because it's like, as I said, I didn't do an English degree. I haven't done a journalism degree. But what I try and do is set the scene. So like, if I'm with like, I don't know, Stormzy or whatever, it won't just be an interview with Stormzy. I'll be like, well, where are we? What was the weather like? I want you to picture, if you can, as the reader, where you are. And like over the years, it's been really flattering when people have said to me, I knew that was you before I even saw your name was on it. I could just tell. I'm like, oh, okay, I've done something right over the years, you know. So that's basically what a voice is.
I mean, I was gonna say similarly to Chuck's, like, just I guess I am naive in the structure of like the whole journalism thing, in terms of a career trajectory. You know, I could sit in record label from an intern to an assistant to a middle manager or whatever. But how does it work in the world of like editorial? I guess
hustling. I'm talking specifically about if you're writing within the genre of like rap, grime, whatever. Like it's probably a little bit different if you're a pop writer. Essentially, I suppose, you kind of start off as freelance. You try and get a gig in a magazine, so you're like a staff writer or editorial assistant or a music editor. And then I guess at some point you want to be an editor. It depends. If you look at like from Chantel Fiddy to myself to Laura, Hyperfrank to JP, everyone's going to be slightly different and everyone's goals are different.
So
there isn't a structure. It is just a lot of hustle, because it's like if you're wanting to work in a label, it's the equivalent of basically going repeatedly to each label and doing a little bit of work for them each month. So you're constantly like,
I get that.
Building that sort of.
And who's the boss in a magazine? Who's the boss?
It's tricky. So I'm at ID Magazine now, which is a lot to do with it's style and fashion, and it's very led by images. So the boss is the editor in chief, like she is 100% the boss. But there's also like the art director, the creative director. Yeah. They have quite a lot of say too. So it depends. And then if you flip it, like if you look at Fader and Complex and ID or Noisy, the online now is so important. So actually, probably the digital manager is as important now at a magazine or at a title as a print equivalent, so it's changing.
Okay, before we move on to the next part as well, I'm bringing this up purely on the basis of something that happened a little while ago here, which made me think about this. Are there like writing codes, like, of do's and don'ts. And the reason why I say that is because I remember we did an interview here and we had it filmed, and there was something that happened. I'm not sure. We was trying to figure out what the problem was. And when I was speaking to the guy who is the cameraman, he said, oh, he went against one of the codes that you have as a cameraman or whatever.
Okay.
So I thought, like, that, which made me think when I was doing the prep for you, are there things that are like do's and don'ts when writing an article, like real, like genuine codes?
I mean, I guess the off the record thing is probably a key thing. Like, if someone says to you, as a lot has happened a lot of times over the years, I might interview certain people and they'll be like, oh, this bit's off the record, or like sometimes, you know. So off the record basically means you can't print it. I don't know how much legal weight it actually holds.
Probably none.
But you know, for me, morally, ethically, someone says to me, you know, this is off the record, or like say when you do a biog interview, or if I ghostwrite a book for someone, they're going to tell me a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
They might get to approve that, and then like, we want to take this, I want to take that out. So it's up to me now to not be like, oh, Benny, you're not going to believe this. I interviewed so-and-so last week and they told me, you know, that's just not cool. So you are a confidant in some ways. Like, and I hope that what I've done over the years is basically, a lot of the time, is to keep my mouth shut. I don't really get involved in stuff. I don't chat people's business. And if people tell me stuff that's, you know, off the record or whatever, then that's one code. And I think the other code is more informal, but like from when I started out and I met like Chantel at Touch Magazine and a guy called Russell Myrie, I think that it was about building together and not not going competing against each other.
Yeah.
So like, you know, maybe that's a little bit different with the younger generation. I don't know, because I don't get involved in the politics like that. But like, it's just like, you know, you should sort of share and share alike. So like, if you can't do something, then you offer it to your mate, you suggest your mate. I don't know, there's like a kind of that sort of code where it's like, don't step on people. I mean, that's just a general life code, right? Yeah, but like, not stepping on people, or not encroaching on people's territories, not taking a job that you know that you shouldn't really be writing, because actually that person
can deal with that.
So there's those kind of things.
Shout out to our cameraman, by the way.
Yeah. What was the cameraman code? What was that?
I think the code was, it was something to do with the angle.
Okay.
It was literally just starting to do that, but yeah, it was an angle thing. Yeah, you know, it literally looked like he was in a completely different place to us, and it was just some kind of code thing or whatever.
So you're earning like 35 quid a week.
I swear to God, yeah. I'm not.
What year are we now, though? Where
this is 2002.
Okay.
2002-ish. Yeah. So Touch Magazine is like 30-35 quid a week. It's basically a fiver a day, travel and like so-called lunch.
Okay.
So that was, you know, those were lean years, and those lean years lasted, and also those lean years could come back at any point.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, I remember a long time after, I keep going back to Chantel because we sort of basically started our careers together. So myself and Chantel Biddy, we both got like the same sort of role at Touch, and when Touch folded after say about a year or so of us being there, or 2 years, and during this period, like, she'd gone to interview Justin Timberlake in LA, I'd gone to interview Missy Elliott in Puerto Rico, like things that people would go, oh, you've made it, you must be earning so much cash. And we were both writing for other publications. When Touch went, and another magazine we were supposed to work at, didn't end up setting up in time, whatever. So there was a period when we were just like, maybe we should just give up.
Really?
Like, maybe we should just give up. And lots of journalists along the way that we worked with at that point have since like gone on to do other things. So times were tough, it was a bit peak for a little while, but I'm also of the understanding that it could happen again. You know, journalism is a tough industry, it's a very unreliable industry, and it's an ever-changing industry. I'm always looking at other things to do outside, you know, like maybe I'll go and be a teacher someday. I don't know.
It's really interesting, like when you go through that period in your career where you're actually, you're doing things, it might not be financially rewarding just yet.
Yeah.
To everyone, they think that you're completely killing it.
You are balling, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's hard to sometimes even say, you know, like, for example, you say to someone, you don't even really want to say I'm going Puerto Rico, because they're going to get the whole thing of, oh my God, you must be getting paid this must be happening or whatever. Like,
I got paid 35 quid to do that Missy Elliott cover for Blues and Soul magazine, which is all these magazines I'm mentioning are now all dead.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, when I went to do that, and I remember I got paid £35, and I had to get the advance from the editor because I was going to Puerto Rico with no cash. Although, like, when you go on these things, it's obviously, if it's all paid for, but obviously I'm still in Puerto Rico. So, but when that came out and it went into Blues and Soul, someone said to me, you should just try and get that in the Guardian Guide. And I was like, oh, I could never write for the Guardian.
Yeah.
Which is another really important thing, actually. It's like holding yourself back. I think I've done that a few times over the years. I've been like, well, I couldn't write for the Guardian because it's the Guardian.
Yeah.
And then I ended up writing for the Guardian. I did a piece on Misty for them, and it was a cover story, and blah 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 blah. And then, like, even 5 years after that, I was still saying to myself, "Yeah, but I couldn't write for the Sunday Times."
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, you're limiting yourself in your mind to start off with. Which, exactly. Yeah, I hear you. So, all right, you have been doing all of this amazing stuff in America. May not be like financially rewarding just yet, though. But you know what I mean. Building, laying two bricks and that.
Yeah.
You've got this relationship now with Chantel Philly,
yeah,
who is very interested in grime.
Yes.
I believe that she kind of had a conversation with you. Talk to me a little bit about your relationship with Chantel Philly and how put you on into grime.
I shout out to Shan all the time because...
big up, Shan. I ain't seen her for ages.
She's good. No, she's still doing her thing. I wasn't in America. My whole desire to go to America stopped because I ended up working at Touch, which was based at the time in Archway. And as it happened over the years, I ended up going to America loads.
That's kind of what I meant. Yeah, not living, but yeah.
Chantel, yes, we met, and I remember I remember discovering like 50 Cent, like the 50 Cent first mixtape came out, and then like Wankster came out, and I was like, we've got to do this guy called 50. He's so sick. Shan's like, oh, yeah, whatever. and then on the flip, she's like, you've got to listen to this new kid. You've got to listen to this kid called Dizzy Rascal, and I was like, whatever. Like, I was just so focused on like 50, and she was focused on Dizzy as the kind of two parallels. But I remember she played me, we think it was a white label of I Love You. Neither of us can quite remember what tune it was, but it was sometime around 2002. She'd been on the Pay As You Go video shoot initially, and that's how she sort of met like Genius and Slim Z. So it was still the garage kind of years. So she'd done that, and then she'd gone on and met Wiley and Dizzy. And there's a really iconic shot of them that was in Touch magazine from them in front of the Free Flats that she helped set up. Yeah. So this is that point, and she's like, oh, you've got to hear this kid called Dizzy and blah, 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 and Wiley. And I was like, oh, this sounds shit, man. Turn it off. Can't stand it. It's like horrible. It's so much noise. I just thought it was noise. I'm listening to like 50 and it's all like, and then there's this like guy shouting about yats and skits. Yeah, yeah, and I was like, oh, God, no, not for me. But about a week later, I was like, Shan, that tune you play, play me it again? And I was like, play me again. And I was like, shit.
I love you.
You
got fired up.
Oh, well. You got whacked up. Oh, well. And that was it. I was kind of like, my interest was so peaked. And then basically her old flatmate, who also worked at Touch at the time, he moved out. My old flatmate was getting married, so I had to kind of move out because the husband was moving in. Awkward scenes.
Yeah.
So Shan was like, oh, there's a room in my place going. So we ended up then living together for like maybe a year or two. And obviously, at that point, Chantel was just like the absolute queen of grime. Like, everyone came through her because of like Slim Z and Genius really, really trusted Shan. Mm. If Shan said that you were okay, which she did with me, then you were okay. So through Shan, like, I was introduced to everything, like Forward, Rhythm, Rinse, Deja, like all that. She used to get shout outs for us on the radio. I'd be like, gas, like, oh my god, DJ Target, shout out, like, amazing. and we were living in that area, so it was in Bethnal Green. So without Chantel, I have no idea. I might have got an interest in grime, but I might not have known how to like access that talent. So without Fiddy, 100%, it would have been a closed off world to me. She really, really like pulled me up through, and hopefully I've done the same with other people since. She has done the same with other people as well, not just me. So it was a very exciting time, man. It was a very exciting time to live in Bethnal Green. Like, the sorts of people that we would get to meet, Wiley would come round, or like Danny Weed and Target would come round, and we'd make them eat like avocado and corn and stuff. And like, the fuck is this shit? It was just great. It was a really, like, looking back on it now, it was just such an exciting time. And again, but like during that period is that time when I'm telling you about when we were like, should we just give up? Like, should we, do we have to go and do something else? So creatively it was like exciting, but financially it was tough.
So, to use your words, creatively it was exciting. What was the first point that you really dived in and did a did an article in the world of rhyme, and you felt ready.
I remember I got Chantel to read it about a million times because I knew, you know, like back then the forums were a thing. You couldn't say or do anything without a forum. I mean, I'm not just like a journalist, but like Skeptical would get slewed on there, Wiley would get slewed on there, the Rewind Forum. Which is where I went to work later on in my sort of career. A couple of years after that, when I went to work at Rewind, but when I was before that, it was like Dissensus, Rewind Forum.
Forums was probably like one of the first areas of like, that was like the first like period of a troll.
Of a troll.
The trolling was real.
I didn't even.
Jeez, the trolling. That's
That word didn't even exist.
It was just like, we just called it like the internet then.
Yeah.
It was just like, as you just said that, I just was like thinking, wow, yeah, forums were a thing. I forgot
forums were huge. Yeah. Like when I was at Rewind, we had like, maybe numbers that don't sound that big now, but back then we would have like 1, 2, 3 million people on the Rewind forum. Bearing in mind, this is like pre-SBTV, this is pre-channel, well, it's around the time of Channel U, but there was no like marketing of this thing. People just found their way. So yeah, the first thing I wrote, I wrote something for the Guardian Guide, basically on grime. I don't think it had a name then, because I think I was referring it to Ezeski and Sublow and stuff. So it was around that time. What'd you call it? And I think so around 2003. I may have done little bits previous to that in touch with, you know, gone to shoots with. I remember going to one shoot with Shan, and we sort of interviewed a bunch of people. But that was the first sort of piece. And then from there, me and Philly did a piece for ID magazine. I think that was 2004, maybe 2005, where we got like the whole scene. Well, not the whole scene. We tried to get the whole scene, not just the MCs and the DJs, but like the managers. So we had like Richard Thomas was in there with Kano or whatever. We had like radio DJs, like everybody. So that was the first sort of proper big piece, I think, I guess, that I did on grime.
Would you say this was like the first time, like within your career as well, that you started to really feel excited again about something just mad?
Yeah, I think
like something was happening.
Yeah, did you feel writing, that?
Did you? Yeah.
I don't know that. Not to the extent that it would. I think no. Like it's weird. Like I've mentioned this before somewhere, but like I always wanted to be, you know, like I was saying, I'm such a big hip hop head. My dream was, if I could have gone back in time, would have been to like 1970s Bronx to have been able to have been born amongst hip hop. But I'm sure it was the same back then. They were just like hooking up lights to the street lamps and like putting two decks together and having a party. But then the rest of it was normal life. So
let me ask you this though: Do you think now that we're having arguably the second phase of grime, do you recognise? Do you feel anything around it like this time, like because you're like noticing trends from the first time?
Yeah, you can feel that now, definitely. And maybe you could, you know what it was at the time? I remember, like, say for example, when I think it was Sovereign, Lethal B, and Dizzy, maybe, I can't remember what it was. There was three artists that went to New York, and we were like, oh my god, grime is gonna blow, is this it? Like, we really thought all these things like would
Jay-Z
happen.
Jay-Z signed
Sovereign.
Where is she now?
Urban.
Where is she?
Should we have a moment for Lady Sovereign?
Where is Lady Sovereign?
She's up, I think she's up north somewhere. I got in touch with her for the book.
She's from Wembley. Isn't it?
She's
from Northwest.
Your ends. There was a lot of things happening back then. I'm trying to think of there was a thing at the Urban Music Festival, which I think was 2004, and Jay-Z played.
Who was there?
And do you remember they brought out?
This comes up every time. This is so legendary.
This is important with our careers.
Look, it's so sick to hear everyone's different perspective of what happened and what they tuned into that day. So let's not interrupt you.
Well, my memory of that day is that. I think it was the next year Rewind did something at it. Was it 2006? Was it 2004? Jay-Z, Beyoncé. Like
Alicia Keys was there.
Alicia Keys. There was all these like big American artists, but it was the British artist that like it felt like stole the show, right?
Where was it? Elle's Court one.
Elle's Court. Because the next, I don't think it was that year or the next year that what were you doing there then? We were just fans.
We were trying to work out what was going on in the music industry.
We were sitting there thinking, we need to work in music. This is mental.
Do you remember like when everyone had like the Rocks?
Yes.
That was. But who played that day from the UK? Was that the next one?
No, there was someone early. I think, I don't know if it was Kano, but it was like...
Oh, was it Kano? I can't remember. Dizzy?
It was very early. I don't think Dizzy did that, though. if I remember rightly.
I remember that.
But they were on, like, we were on pretty early. I do remember
there's
that.
There's a story about it, and this is grand, you know, it's gone out of my head, but yeah, there was something that happened there where like, Rewind had a bit of involvement with it, and they passed on some stuff, some British stuff, to like Jay-Z or whatever.
Mm.
There was some seeds were sown at that thing. Anyway, these are the sorts of things that like we would be like, this is it. Grime is going to blow. It's going to take over. You know, Roll Deep got signed to Relentless. All these sorts of things started happening, and so yeah, there must have been an atmosphere of anticipation around the scene at that time. But I don't know that. There was so much normal life going on that, like, I just think I wish I'd videoed more. I wish I'd like
taken
more notice, because same. Like the nights you went to, the nights we put on, and like we put on a night with ID Live where like everyone played from Skepta to Kano to Wiley, Crazy Titch, Lady Sovereign, Katie Pearl. Like we had like this whole night of just like, and we probably charged people like a fiver to get in, and then probably like 30 or 40 the biggest names in Grime that night. And those kind of times are gone. So
yeah,
you just don't maybe appreciate, you never appreciate it at the time.
No,
I feel like now probably people have a little bit more awareness of it. The only thing is now is there's so much of it.
Exactly.
There's so many.
I was thinking actually just on what you were saying about wishing that you filmed more and took more pictures and stuff. I feel like that all of the time. And I think, like, I say to my little brothers, yeah, like, when you lot are doing your thing or whatever, like, take pictures and do all of that. But then I think, because it's just so much of it, now you can just take a million pictures at once. Like, will it still mean the same?
Yeah, you have to actually get, like, a camera and not do it on your phone. So that it becomes a thing.
Do they still get excited about having their name shouted out on the radio?
I think people are desensitized to celebrity in any way. Like, you know, just
because you can also build your own platforms. Like, you know, say if you're like, say if you're Jay Huss, whatever, or you're Dave, or you're like AJ Tracy. Like, you're getting immediate reactions from people on your own platforms.
Mm.
So, do you really need a radio station or a magazine or an online station to verify you when you can say, but I've got 30,000 people that just like my picture, or not 10,000 people, whatever, that's just like my picture, or I don't know. There's so much more direct access between artist and the fan, if you like, or the follower,
definitely,
or whatever.
Definitely.
That I think artists are much more aware now of their power, which is both a good thing, but also from the other side, it's harder because there is no sort of wedge between it, and we're losing a little bit, I think, of like the idea that, you know, because it is really important that we have radio stations that kind of curate the sort of and separate the sort of the good from the bad, or like, you know, that tell it, not that can like guide people into like new music.
I actually feel, I'm not even just saying it because we're here, but I feel like radio has been a blessing in the sense that, like, I've seen with my own eyes now, like, some young kids thinking, like, I want to try and get on radar so I can spit my bars now. Because I felt like we were going through a part where nobody was really thinking about it like that too much. You could just do it yourself, you could just get a camera, you could just, you know what I mean? I think maybe the fact that we've had, like, some real cool artists that have gone to a different planet with their music now, come here, still spit bars, made, like, them think, you know what, rah, like, they're coming here, I've seen it on YouTube, I want to be able to get a go and do that, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that's, I remember, like, I was talking to Tinchy Strider, like, recently-ish, and he was saying about, like, it wasn't just that you got onto Deja or Rinse back then, like, you had to work your way up through so many different levels of pirate before you even got anywhere close to, like, the big boys, and I think that's something that radar can kind of bring back. It's like something to work towards. It's like, you know what, if you want to get on radar, you better be fucking good.
Because
we're not just going to have any MC and his mate up there.
Exactly.
You have to have something to say.
Mm.
And you never know, you might spit next to a big Donny, but let's let's go back a little bit though.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Rewind.
Okay.
For me, that was a magazine. That was like the first magazine
that I was
reading. It was, so necessary for the scene back then. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, your involvement with Rewind,
so I was,
and also how important it was to the scene from your perspective.
Rewind, I think, probably still is quite an unsung hero. Like, it's crazy when you think back of how much it did and how much it was involved in the scene.
Just break it down, because it's like there might be some younger listeners that don't even
Rewind.
Know what it is.
Rewind, RWD. No one ever knew how to pronounce it, but we used to say it Rewind. So basically, Rewind started as a free magazine It started kind of as a garage magazine, like UK garage magazine. It's like very glossy. It looked nice, like it had ads in it, and they were like the people that set it up. There's four people that set it up, and then a guy called Matt Mason, who was a DJ at the time in the garage scene, could see the grime scene coming through, and he was like, you know what, you've got this great product, but you need to do it to the people that actually care. Like young kids now are listening to grime, well, it wasn't called grime then, this new music, and so basically, like Matt just kind of help them put it in the hands of people, and so like it's hard to really explain. Yeah, they basically had like, so you could like pay, sometimes you could pay for content, right? So it ran itself a little bit, it wasn't too dependent on advertisers, but they would basically take, you know, everyone from like a 16-year-old Dizzy Rascal and put them on the cover, whereas most magazines had a hierarchy. They'd be like, you can't put someone who's only had one record on the cover, whereas Rewind didn't give a shit. They were like, we don't care. They also had people that wrote for them that were from the scene. So the journalism wasn't always that great. So for us at Touch Magazine, we were a bit sniffy about it. We were like, I mean, have you seen the grammar? It's all over the place. Because it would just be like these kids that are just written stuff, and like you'd get some like really scatty Q&A with someone that didn't really make any sense. But if you were like a consumer, you would pick up the magazine and be like, oh, this is who's hot right now. You didn't even necessarily have to read it. Do you know what I mean? You would just see. So that was kind of the Rewind structure, and it was free. You got it at all the major places like Rhythm Division or Black Market. And yeah, that was how it started. And then I came into it around 2005, 2006. And, you know, we switched up a little bit at that point. We sort of went on to encompass people like the Ed Sheerans, people that were touching the scene, that weren't in the scene, but that were touching the scene in different ways. So, so Rewind was a magazine. It had this massive forum. Like, it's hard to sort of explain its kind of importance, really. But they would do stuff like the Boo Crew, which is this comic thing, which is like which is a bit like a Corrupt FM. In a cartoon kind of thing.
It covered like so much things, not just music, but just everything that was going on. Like we just within
and
culture.
And at the office, you would have like, you know, like just I think because no one had anywhere to go, so like, Jammer would come down, Wiley would be there, Skepta would come through. Like it was just a bit at one point, like in the early, in the sort of mid noughties, not so much later on, but people just used to hang out there. And like just want to be in a magazine and just like, and then we sort of, they were really early on the online thing, but I think didn't quite make the jump where sort of then SDB TV came in and just did it really well. I think Rewind, if it kind of harnessed that sort of like YouTube moment, it might have
mad to think about that times, isn't it, because the power shift is crazy.
There was a girl we had working for us who sadly died, Bianca, and she had bought that. I remember her coming with a camera and she was saying like, I filmed all these MCs, like you should put this online. And I think at the time the MD was a bit like, we don't really know what you, like why would we give away content for free, it's filmed, it's going to cost. So actually Bianca was really ahead of the time. She sadly died, but a year or two later you had obviously Jamal came along with his camera and it's mad, isn't it,
but yeah, I've still got a stack. I've probably got a stack about this high of Rewind magazines still.
It's
now
crazy, isn't it?
I need to actually just flip
there's
that
some through really interesting stuff. There's some really like history wise, if you want to learn about, especially about like grime, and even dubstep, like they cover a lot of dubstep. Whatever was happening, it was able to react really quickly. A lot of magazines like Elle and all those sorts of magazines, or The Enemy or whatever, they would work a month or two in advance. Whereas we would just be like, we would be writing stuff on the day it was going to print. Like we would shoot the cover 2 days before. It was very like the scene. It was very like the culture of grime. It was just DIY, ad hoc, do it yourself. Be like a bit rebellious, be a bit punk with it, and just put out
the
magazine.
And I actually saw you tweet the other day a cover of one of the magazines. I think it had
Titch and Jamie.
One? And I think you had Kanye was on the inside.
Yeah. We would do that. We'd be like, and here's a feature with Kanye West. We had Jamie and Crazy Titch on the cover, and then like you turn it inside, it's like Kanye West. It put British artists before American artists, which until then no one had really done, in certainly in magazines and definitely not on TV. Like the way that Channel U took away from MTV base by saying, actually, we're going to support British acts.
Punch in the face, punch in the face. Nobody wants a punch in the face.
Happen to the days when you just get a punch in the face. How did things, you know, for you as a journalist, how did things pan out when artists from the grime scene, that was obviously an underground genre, started to cross over and subsequently became pop stars and massive? You know, as a specialist you know, in this genre. How did that change for you?
For me personally, it was fine because I was what I've always done throughout my career is like is never pin myself down to one thing. So while all the time I was at Rewind, I was always freelancing. I've only ever done anywhere. I've only ever worked 3 or 4 days a week because I just never wanted to attach myself to one thing.
Yeah,
I wanted it to be more about. God, it sounds so like I don't know. Self-obsessed about me, but I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be just Rewind or just ID. So for me, it was great because it meant like, you know, when Tiny Temper was like, became huge, I would do his biogs for the label.
Yeah.
I didn't do media training for Tiny, but like I've done media training for people. And when he came to do a book, him and Dummy were like, hey, you want to help us write the book? So for me, it was brilliant. Like for Rewind, we did suffer because a lot of people then didn't want to be on Rewind anymore. There wasn't the right environment for them.
This is what I'm saying, you know, that all these different angles, did you feel like...
if you feel a way about it. Yeah. Like, I mean, yes, you know, and also, I mean, there was a lot of politics, you know, we fell out with a few artists along the way, which is fine. I don't mind those as much as the ones that are like, we're too big for Rewind now. It's the same, it's like, you know what, you know, like, and I hope this happens with the Rated R Awards, but like, you know, it's not just about doing the Brits and the Mercuries. You know, it's great. I'm so happy that Skepta and everybody went to the Rated Awards this year because it's so important, and it's really important that you still do Radar. It's really important that you still do Link Up. You know, just because you're on a platform with like, you know, like a mainstream platform, don't forget about the core audience, because also that's when things perhaps don't go so well in 4 or 5 years' time, that's where you'll be coming back to.
Well, the thing is, it's gone full circle, and what's good is that like the same generation of artists that.
Yeah.
you know, you mentioned Skepta. Skepta has seen this from its inception, and has had a degree of mainstream success or whatever, and maybe felt like, oh, I'm trying to elevate and be ambitious and I don't want to do that anymore. But then coming all the way back around to thinking, actually, no, do you know what? We need to embrace the people that really care, because, you know, the mainstream media is ruthless. They care when you're hot, and when you're not, you can't even ring them. So,
yeah, and also for yourself, like if you look at Drake, it's like it actually helps the artist to be connected with that younger generation. Yeah. It's like it gives them cool, like it gives them relevancy that you lose as you become more successful. And actually, you really need the Radar. You need that Radar audience because like it's always going to come back to that. It's never going to be about what the mainstream likes that continues to propel you. It's always that underground swell that tastemaker level of people that are what, you know, kind of you build your career on. So
yeah
it was tough. There was a few years where there was a few artists where you definitely fell out with a few people,
but from the other side of things and stepping away from Rewind specifically, and you as a freelance journalist, were you not getting the call up now from the guys at the Guardian saying, hey we need you to interview Tiny or to whoever?
Well, actually, do you know what, it's funny because you would see this with you know, the Sunday Times is a particular culprit of this. So you would say, if I don't know if I ever did do this Tiny Temper for them, but like say I did Tiny for them 1 week, the next week I couldn't go back and pitch Skepta because they'd already done one grime act.
Okay,
which basically
one in
basically,
one out policy.
It was pretty racist. Yeah. Like they, so they would do like week in week out, they would do indie and pop acts, you know, aka white acts, and then, but funnily enough, with black acts, we did one like 3 weeks ago. It was still, I'm talking about that 2010 sort of period. You know, I'm sure, Tinchy, Tiny, all those guys that were doing Chip, all those guys that were doing really well were probably still only allowed to do so much. That I think has changed a lot now. It's actually flipped completely the other way. So thankfully, you know, times have changed. But as it wasn't that long ago where things were still, and we're, like, you know, with Rewind, we would find, you know, advertisers. We would say, like, we've got 100,000 people reading this magazine. These are like people that have got access to, like, let's say, I don't know, whatever, 40 quid a week. Like, you know, young kids who've got, like, spending money. We've got students. We've got, like, young professionals. This is, our, you know, our 16 to 24 age range, where if we had been, like, a magazine that was doing pop music, we would have had people throwing cash at us. But because it was Rewind magazine, there was, you know, a lot of people that were slow to take up the advertising. So you do still see issues.
Yeah.
I think we might have just missed a tiny bit.
Yeah.
At what point did you quit, like, doing the odd jobs? And did this become, like, a full-time job for you? Like, within that period of time of everywhere we've just been talking about just here, at what point was it the point of, I don't need to sign on anymore, I don't need to do these odd jobs anymore, like, I can actually now start making a living? Where was that?
I think I poured my last pint at a pub in southeast London around 2004.
Okay.
I think maybe 2005.
So that was the time you was living with Chantal Philly?
No, before I moved in to Philly's place. This was like, yeah, this was about, I've been in touch for maybe about a year and a bit.
Okay.
Maybe, it was about 2 years fully into like writing.
Yeah.
I think that I was only doing like the odd shift just to like, you know, get a bit more cash, you know, like I'm talking like 30, 40 quid or whatever. Because at some point at Touch, we did start to get paid more than 30 quid a week.
Yeah,
not much more, but like we got a bit more cash. So yeah, it took about 2 years, really, realistically. It took about 2 years to actually, yeah, finally stop doing the odd jobs and just about scrape by each month on either Touch. But because when we left Touch, then it was like purely freelance until I got to Rewind, which I think did happen pretty quickly, within a year. So there was a year where it was very, very tough. You might, you know, if you're talking like Blues and Soul magazine are paying you £35-40 a piece, you're not going to eat really too well. And the Guardian pieces I would get, you know, you get 300 quid for, but that would be like, I probably did like three over 1 year. So, you know, it wasn't easy to make cash back then.
And like with the rise of the scene, you know, obviously the artist starts to make more money, obviously the manager makes more money, the DJs, the producers, but do the journalists of that scene start to actually make more money? Like,
I don't think they did not in the mid-noughties. I think now probably, like I'm sure, like if I look at everybody from like JP to Laura to myself, I'm used to thinking of the same names, you know, there's lots of other journalists out there, but like, you know, JP's at Complex now, you know, like I think we have all probably benefited from the last 2 years more than ever before. But yeah, during that mid-noughties, like 2005, 6, 7, 8, not so much. But maybe that final, so that being the sort of Roll Deep kind of sort of years. But I think when sort of, when like Chip and Tinchy and Tiny, perhaps from then on in, maybe that was so until about the end of the noughties, more so, there was maybe a bit more work.
Yeah.
A bit more cash we made. But like the scale probably from like artists, if it goes like artist or manager, lawyer, manager, artist, through down to like DJs and producers and stuff, there'll be a big massive drop before you see any, like you'll see what the writers get. No one gets into writing for the money, I don't think. Which isn't to make myself sound like I'm not, you know, getting by and doing well and stuff. Lots of journalists have, you know, managed to buy houses and stuff off writing, and it is possible, and I'm in a really good place now, like I'm, you know, I've got my 3 days at ID. I turn down work because I'm so busy. It can make it work, but it, you know, don't get into journalism if you think you're going to make a million.
I thought it was really interesting reading about you. I think you first discovered that you noticed that brands had a budget to do certain things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that one of the first things, I could be wrong, but one of the first things that we maybe saw as brand collaboration was the stuff that you did with G-Shock.
You look really well researched.
And Titch. Like, talk to us a little bit about
that. We've got a whole research team out here doing stuff for us.
You're not going to start to get me out of a job, man.
We don't.
We need to stop preparing for interviews. G-Shock was the first thing. I have to shout out Sarah Salter from G-Shock, because that was another thing that came through ID. I was in New York doing a thing with, they did a collaboration with Spike Lee and Kanye West, and I just met someone from G-Shock. They were obviously on the trip, my who's now become a mate, Sarah, and I was just banging on, because I did back then, I was just banging on about Grime. I was like, yeah, you know, Kanye's great, but you should listen, remember when me and Fiddy went to interview Pharrell I went to interview him for ID maybe 2007 or something like that, maybe 2008, you know, we took along like everyone's CD, we took along like Wiley's CD, we took along Dizzy. Like whenever I interviewed American artists, I would always take mixed. I would always do a mix for them, and I'd be like, "Hey, here's some English music," which more or less most time than probably just throw away, but it was so important to me. So on that trip, I was just banging on about this, you know, this Grime and stuff and blah blah blah. And at some point, she must have come back to me a few weeks later and said, "You know, you said that you know like certain artists. Do you think you might be able to like help us put a little film together?" And I was like, yeah. At that time, I knew, for some reason, because I knew Tiny pretty well back then, for some reason I just knew that he wore G-Shock. I don't remember how I knew that, but I was like, oh, there's a guy called Tiny, he'll do it. I know Tinchy, I'm sure he'll, you know, like, you're basically putting together a film of people wearing G-Shock.
So you're basically like, responsible for him having a crazy dumb collection. Okay, now
you
we
know what? If I'd
from.
Known he was going to do that line, I would have parlayed myself some more P out of G-Shock for that.
You need a little publishing. Call Demi now.
Been good to me, but yeah, G-Shock I should have got. I think they must have sold a few more watches off that. I should have shot a chart. Yeah, so that was me just hollering at people that I knew at that point who, again, you know, these they were people that like me were just wanting to do stuff. I was like, oh, I'm doing this thing for G-Shock. Like, there's no money because there's never any money, but like, I can give you a bunch of free watches. And Dynamo, Tinchy, Tiny, I got Westwood to do it. I got Sierra to do it. Okay. Like just like, and I just rolled up with whoever. I can't remember who filmed it for me. I must have just got someone to film it. And we just filmed this little thing. And G-Shock were like, gave it to G-Shock. They just included it at a presentation. It didn't go anywhere. So from the artist's point of view, they weren't getting rinsed or anything. Well, they were getting a bit rinsed. Sorry, guys. Or they weren't getting. I mean, I was getting rinsed. Like, it wasn't.
You know what? But we, no one knew the value though, of it, yeah. At that time.
Didn't
realize
the value.
And actually, you know, getting stuff and not paying for it was like, that was insane. That was an insane concept.
Yeah,
like,
we would get different boxes of trainers and I'd be like, I can keep this.
Yeah. It's mad.
Nah, exactly.
So yeah, that was how it started. And then I just did a blog for them, and that was where it was a bit more reciprocal for artists because like the blog was quite a thing. And so people were, so I'd hook people up with watches, and then I'd cover stuff, but I would also cover stuff, in ID or whatever. So they were getting, it was a bit more sort of like a two-way street. So, but most of the time with G-Shock, it was just more like them saying to me, we want to work with artists, who should we work for? And I would say, you should work with this person, that person. And then Tiny probably got us paid like $5,000 to do a PA, at that point, to do a PA with whoever. So the money sort of started to come in. And I think G-Shock actually, to be fair, as a brand, we were really supportive. Same with Red Bull, I'm always a bit cautious around brands, and it kind of makes you cringe when brands get involved. But I think like Red Bull, for me personally, I think it's a really good example of how brands work really well.
Yeah.
Incredibly, I think, within the scene. I think they've actually probably at some points paid people's rent,
Definitely.
In the 2012 times. It was a bit like the beginning of my career. It was all a bit of a mistake. I didn't mean to go and to holler at brands and say, can I work for you? But I suppose because it was just second nature to me to champion this music all the time, whoever I met. I must have been very boring, because probably all of us spoke to people about, hell about crime. Like, they would be like, well, actually, yeah, we have had a little bit, and maybe we should get this person in to come and do stuff. So, yeah, working with brands was just a very natural thing. I didn't try and force it. It just kind of came. So from then, I've worked with a bunch of different people.
And now we know the value, so we
You can do, you can make so much money. And for me, it was like enjoyable work as well. It wasn't like doing like, I can't think of an equivalent, but it's stuff that I enjoy doing. Do you know what I mean? And so, and it's good for me because it means I'm going to people. Like, I did something with like Reebok maybe a year ago, and I interviewed Getz that day, and I'd noticed he was wearing Reeboks. And so I rang him, I was like, look, there's like X amount of cash to do this thing tomorrow. Do you want to do it? And he's like,
yeah.
Safe.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, come on. Yeah.
So it's nice that, I'm sort of helping to feed on other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Without that, they might not have asked Getz. They might have asked, like, I don't know, Pixie Lott or something. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
So big up Getz. I saw him at New Balance event about 2 months ago. probably getting that same dough. I'm joking. So, recently Stormzy was pretty upset on Twitter because of the enemy sort of like misrepresenting him on the cover.
Yep.
And I'm not, I'm not asking you to necessarily give us like a bad day at journalism, but just to talk generally about the madness of like interviews and how you can have 9 amazing interviews and then you could have one where you thought it went well, you printed it and then it all kind of.
There must be, let me give you some good ones. Who have I upset in the past? I mean, there's been plenty of people. Do you know what? Later years, I tend to try and keep my upset to a minimum. But like, certainly in the early years when I first started writing, I was a bit renegade. If I didn't like something, I'd quite happily say it. Yeah. And like, I've learned to be a bit more tactful. I've also learned to sort of consider the fact that actually people have got feelings and they might have spent a year making this album that I've just shat all over. So, I remember doing an interview with Mystique back in the day, and the editor told me this bunch of questions to ask them, which I asked them, which were terrible, is it true you bully Sue Elise or whatever? Like, just, can you even sing? So, like, they were just really obnoxious, horrible questions. And so obviously they reacted as anybody would. Fuck yourself. But then of course, I wrote that up like, oh, they were so this and so that. And then the piece ran and they cut out the other two girls and they just put Alicia on the cover. And it was just this really horrible story, which I, was really responsible for. And I remember feeling inside so wrong about that.
Yeah.
But that was, for me, was like, I don't think I'm going to do that again. I'm not going to let an editor tell me this is an angle of a story before I've even met the person. Let me go and meet the people and find out for myself. Yeah, so I learned pretty early on. I'm trying to think, there's never been any, I'm trying to think of anything I've written. I mean, I'm sure there are maybe things in the book that maybe people weren't too happy with.
Yeah.
No one's kind of come to me and said that yet, but there might have been things in the book that people are like, well, why did you include that quote when you knew that might have upset that person? But I'm sure, yeah, nothing too crazy.
I always find it interesting when, you know, this is when I said to you, when I even introduced you, I said, you know, there's only a handful of people in this game that you can really trust in terms of like journalism and writing about what happens within the scene, the culture or whatnot. I mean, now because of how far the scene has come and some of the amazing things that people are doing, naturally all types of people are writing about it and whatnot.
Right.
But then you have, with that, you have people that like misrepresent things that happen within the game. For example, you know, I remember when Skepta did his show at Alexandra Palace,
right.
And then someone wrote about there being a technical difficulty because he had to restart the song.
That was in a big publication. Yeah, and that is
I mean,
wild.
you had the Gigs review as well. You know, where it talked that they said that
God, dear, that is just
you know, the thing is for me, right, as a journalist, if someone said to me, can you go and write about the 1975, and this does happen, like I sometimes get phone calls from, I don't know, Five Live or the Today programme, and they say, oh, can you come and talk about Kylie's new route? And I'm like, no, I can't come and talk about Kylie. I have got nothing against her, but I don't know about her. I can't put her in any context. I can't talk about her knowledgeably. So it's up to these journalists to say, you know what, I'm not the right person to review Skepta, I'm not the right person to review Gigs.
That's the interesting word that you just used there as well, like, which is very important for a journalist, is context.
Mm.
You know, because, you know, you could easily just turn around and say, yeah, I'll write about Kylie or whatever it may be. But to have the context is a completely different thing.
What's the point? Yeah.
You know? And then when you have people that are writing for like big organisations that are talking about what's going on within the scene and not really understanding it and not putting the right context to the situation.
Well, also because the scene has so many people ready already to view it in a certain way. You know, like the Daily Mail, for example. Like, you have to be... We have so much responsibility as journalists to make sure that we're representing Black British music correctly, because it's a genre of music that people are very, very ready to project all sorts of shit all over. You have to be really, really careful, and you have to be really, really conscious that what you're writing is being portrayed correctly and that you're portraying the artist correctly, because we've seen the massive effects that it can have on a scene when people get behind it, and you know, like with Garage and stuff, when like they kind of shut Garage down, and Grime with this Form 696, all these things. You know, I'm not saying that journalists are to blame, but like as commentators or journalists or people involved, you know, managers, whatever, like you have to understand. And I think it's the same across music. Like I used the Kylie example, but I think particularly with Grime and rap, like the people are already, the detractors are there waiting. They're looking for any excuse to which sounds a bit conspiracy theorist, but you know what I'm saying. You know, like, I think it's just something that has to be really, really well thought out. And so don't write that review if you don't know the fact that this is a reload.
I think as well, you know, like, maybe a journalist just doing something and just writing a review that they haven't necessarily, like, researched that well, they might see the backlash from the general public, or they might not, but what they definitely, they may see if the artist vocalises it, but it can really affect an artist. It can really make an artist think, do you know what? I just did an interview that I didn't necessarily even want to do, or someone's just done a review that I didn't even ask for, and now like I'm really pissed off because I've put my heart and soul into this, or, you know, for my life, or...
Yeah, well, what if, like,
or...
what if Stormzy now decides he doesn't want to talk about depression again or anxiety again? Like, it's so important that Stormzy is talking about that, because as a young man, you know, this is a big issue that young men have, and so what if that puts him off? And that is a responsibility of the NME for that, because, I mean, I'm sure it won't stop him from talking about it, but it obviously gives him pause to think, okay, next time I talk about something, and it's going to be something that people really focus on, what effect is it going to have long term? Yeah, I think people have a responsibility, like you say, to consider the artist, what effect it might have, not just on the artist and their team, but also on the audience as well. Because we need people like Stormzy to keep talking about subjects like this.
Yeah, Totally.
So, you know, you've got an amazing book out. We'll talk just a little bit about
that. I think
I've
mentioned it about 18 times. I should have brought it with me. Like.
This is Grime out now.
Yeah.
Retailers.
That's right.
Amazon. Can you just break down, like, can you tell us everything you're doing right now? Like, who are you working with at the moment? Okay. Like, break it down for us who you're working with at the moment. Take a deep breath and then just list off some interesting...
Well, actually, this year, I'm trying to be a little bit more chill because last year... Okay, so last year, I was at ID 3 days a week.
Okay.
I did the book. This is Grime. I was at a project for Selfridges.
What does that mean?
The project I did for Selfridges was brilliant, actually. I worked with Selfridges and Ella Draw PR to basically bring grime and rap into Selfridges. They did this thing on Shakespeare. So obviously, you know, hip hop has a really close relationship with Shakespeare in a sense that, you know, it's poetry and stuff. So it was people like Crepton Conan, we had James Messiah, we had Reggie Snow, we had a novelist who did hosted an amazing evening talking about the importance of like poetry and rap and blah, blah, blah. So that was the Selfridges thing, and I did a fanzine to go with that. And I think I also did something for Ballantine's Whiskey. I sound like a brand co right now. Which was like a zine for them about Brazilian music, so what's popping in Brazil right now, back then. So that was my year last year, and like then I basically nearly died because the workload was so insane.
Wow.
So this year, I'm basically focusing a little bit on the book. We're looking at doing an exhibition in a couple of months.
Yeah.
I've got ID. I'm ghostwriting a book for someone. I don't think I can. I probably can say who it is, but I probably shouldn't.
I had it in mind. Was it someone that you mentioned earlier before we started recording?
Yeah.
Or can we not say that?
I think.
We're not sure. Let's just leave it out.
Yeah. I'm working with someone who can be seen, and it's like, you know, it'll be up to that person to announce when they're
cool.
But so
I'll delete it.
That's what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah. I think that's it. What else have I got? At the moment, yeah, I think that's it. I just did a piece on Dave for The Guardian, so I still do the odd little bits. I might do some biogs, I might do some media training.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to keep it relatively like where the work-life balance in 2017 is a little bit more 50-50 rather than...
You just made me... This I'm just going to just... Amal's phone's ringing in the studio. I mean, this is like amateur hour. What's going on?
God, it wasn't mine, that's all I know.
We'll forgive her. This question just popped into my head because you said, you know, you've just done an interview with Dave. How much is patience required in your job?
I know!
Because it took a minute.
Was that for The Guardian?
This is all on me.
Was that for The Guardian?
But that was partly because, you know, normally I'm just like, normally if someone says to me, who can speak to you at this point, I can just be free all day and I'm at my desk, it doesn't matter. Yeah. There was one of those circumstances where my end, it was really tough for me to be able to make the
phone tennis
full
was
time.
We it was real some, we had it a good real. Rally
so explain to me what was going on here.
We tried to connect on one day, but then I had a friend's birthday at like, you know, so like so Saturday night that was out. I could wait till a certain time and then you guys were away and then we did connect, but then I was in Brighton, I think, at that point. But so then I think by the time you got on the plane or whatever it was, or you were finally settled, you know what, that's different though, like someone having a crazy schedule and you fitting into that is different to people who just can't be asked. Like I hate it when you go to, one of the best times I've ever had was when we went to do Missy Elliott at that time. She was 2 days late and I was like, well, I'm in Puerto Rico. What can I do?
2 days late.
You know, I was like, Missy, take your time, babe. There's no rush. You know, it's cool. I mean, someone said this to me the other day. I was interviewing someone and they were like, oh, she might be late, like, but you know, like, and I was like, it's cool, man. And they were like, oh yeah, of course, it's Hattie, like, it's fine. Like, I appreciate the schedule, you know what I mean? And I appreciate, you know, doing interviews isn't always high on people's priority. That's the other thing about being a journalist now, I think. You know, before, it's where people ask me who's the best person to interview, and I always said the same thing. It's great that you get to interview like all these Beyoncés and Kanyes and Skeptas and Stormzy's. They're all brilliant, but the best people are always the new people because they actually have a bit more energy for it. They want to talk.
Of course.
In some cases, because gigs. In his early career was just not like very not good at talking.
Yeah.
I had to do a Red Bull lecture with Giggs. I was so nervous because you know Giggs is
he's very tough.
He's just not a talker, is he? Like he doesn't, and he doesn't. And I think he thinks about things, but he's just not someone that's like a who's going to sit there and have a nice chat. Yeah, but actually, the Red Bull talk, he was great. Thankfully.
What I like about Giggs, I mean, it would be tough because I know that at some point I'm going to sit down with Giggs and have a conversation with him too. And I've spoken to Giggs millions of times off that, just personally, But like when I've watched his interviews, even just on a research thing, I noticed that like you ask him a question, sometimes he digests it.
Yeah.
And then he tells you how he feels. But when you're actually doing the interview and there's just that like millisecond of silence, you don't know like, okay, do I jump in? Like, what do I, do you know what I mean? But he, you know, he's become very, very charismatic in, he's grown into being a very charismatic guy.
Yeah,
it's amazing to see.
His success is wild. I'm so happy for him. I think he's always done really, really well, and he's had that kind of bass thing. But it's just gone like it's just gone up.
You know what? You'll be hard pressed to find an artist that has genuinely not 1% conformed, like or diluted their music ever,
crazy.
Like on any album, on
any.
You know
what? Apart from, I would say Jamie. Like,
yeah, no, there's a couple. I mean, Jamie definitely.
A different one, because the thing is his content isn't what could be seen as what's the word, troubling. You know, Giggs obviously puts a lot out there. Jamie's a little bit different, he's rapping about vegan cheese, but I think Giggs, and for me, like, people talk about that a lot, about, you know, who hasn't changed and who does change, and you forget, like, you know, pretty much everyone took that deal apart from Jamie.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, Giggs has had deals, but also, you know, like, Jamie has just retained
his own
self. It's crazy.
Batman. We're talking about Giggs. Obviously, you got the book out. This is Grime.
Yeah.
You've got some amazing pictures in there, by the way.
Olivia Rose.
Say shout out to Olivia Rose.
Yes, shout out
to who you done the book with. In the book, you've got Krept and Conan in there as well.
Well, carry on.
Like you mentioned, like Section Boys and whatnot.
Giggs,
I feel like now there was like this period of time where I felt like there wasn't any distinctions between the genres. Yeah, like people would say, okay, this person's grime, this person's a rapper, this person, or you know, like there would always be this conversation about whether a person was grime or whether they were hip hop or whatever it may be. Yeah. Now I feel like the distinctions are a tiny bit more clearer in a sense that, you know, you would look at like Section Boys, for example, you say they make hip hop music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With Giggs though, I still feel like there's like a blurred line between where you would say he was from. Now I know that, you know, people make the argument about like grime just being a culture. Do you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, you still can't take away from the fact of the style of music that they make. But I still feel that like Giggs is probably the one of those artists still who a lot of people still look at as a grime act. Like, what is your take on that?
I see him as rap. I see Giggs as, it's hard because when I've had these conversations with Giggs, he's just like, I'm just a musician.
Yeah.
He doesn't subscribe to that. You know what? Back it out. I think it's actually...
Do you get what I mean? Though?
Yeah.
There's that blurred language.
In the book, we had like, this is not grime. We had a section called This Is Not Grime. And we put Leisha. Because like Lady Leisha is always a bit of a tricky one. Leisha, Giggs, Section. I can't remember who else is in that one. But see, to me, it used to be really clearly defined.
Mm.
Like, see, with Giggs, the reason I don't say he's grime is because he doesn't clash. I know he's done like the guy from Birmingham, Swifter. Swifter production. So he's Swifter beat. So he's done like the faster flow. But to me, he's not from that same pirate clash kind of culture.
Mm.
Where I think it's kind of got confusing. Where, like, I don't know. I feel like Section and Giggs, like Dave. I know Dave sort of is another one where to me it's actually more confusing now than it was. Like, at least with Section Boys, I'm like, well, look, that's trap, that's drill, that's rap. Whereas with like Dave and Jay Huss and like Kojo and Abracadabra, they're all like rapping a little bit, they might sing a little bit, they're doing some Afro beats, they're doing some a little bit of grime. So to me it's more
confusing. Do you reckon as well
now,
like it might have a little bit to do with the fact that like we just like we kind of just want to establish them as ours, and by even mentioning the word hip hop is not really ours as such.
So you, but that's why I would say UK rap.
Yeah, it's so technical. I mean, but well, I would say definitely, I would never think Giggs is grime.
Yeah.
Me personally. I would never question that. I would always think that he's rap. I wouldn't even say hip hop though.
Okay.
I would definitely always say rap. Like, back then, I think we sort of said like road rap. Yeah. Remember Lewis Point when we like, what's like, kind of became Rogue Rat. So gigs, yeah, I don't know. It's more like this post genre that's kind of coming through now. This post grind genre now, where you have got like everybody spilling into everything, makes it a bit more confusing. But I think even like I was talking to Suspect the other day he's from Walworth Road, like part of that sort of gigs crew. He was saying, but calling it UK rap is not right either, because it makes us lesser of a thing compared to rap. Because if you're an American rapper, you're just a rapper. So why are you saying UK rap? That kind of makes it, so I, which I kind of took his point. So course. I don't know.
Yeah, I understand that. I think that's like
them not rap and them not do grime.
And then MC, yeah. They MC.
And there is the blurred lines between, there's new subgenres. Like as you say, like the Haas and the Belly Squads and the Kojos, and they've got melody, they're carrying melody. And it's, melody and it's, crew. It's percussive. The beats are like, you know, there's a style of beat.
You know
what I mean? It's like, it's quite, they're quite sparse, but they're very melodic and they're very percussive.
It just feels, whatever it is, it's a very productive time. Maybe it's people like us that get caught up in the labels and stuff, and maybe artists themselves don't care. But I think it is important maybe to define.
I don't think they do care. I do still think it's interesting. Like, I don't necessarily think that there's wrong with categorizing an artist. I don't think there's a particular problem with that. I also don't necessarily think that we should just pigeonhole an artist into just saying, oh, rah, like, this is just what they should do and they shouldn't do anything else.
Because then what about, like, say, the Stormzy album? I noticed today, particularly, there was particular words used where it said it was the first purely grime album to go to number one. And I'm like, yeah, but Stormzy's got gospel on there.
Yeah, it's meant to.
And R&B. So, I mean, I still think it's a grime album.
But
I understand.
That's what I'm saying. He's a grime artist.
So how could it not be grime?
But he's made a broad album. It's interesting.
A grime artist that's made a broad album. That's a good one still.
Yeah, and I think that it's like, it's sick that he did that, because if I'm just speaking very honestly, like, there's a lot of, and I don't know if this is a word, re-listenability. Is that a word?
Yep. There you go. If it is now.
All right, there you go. Like, there's a lot of re-listenability to the Stormzy record because of the fact that there is dynamic to it. It's not one-dimensional. And, you know, I'm not knocking anything that is just 140 all the way through or sits between those tempos, but it's difficult to listen to that Monday to Sunday.
Yeah,
I might just listen to that on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. Yeah. Do you get what I'm saying?
I think the only person that really did that successfully, still to this day to me, is Dizzy.
Yeah, because
although it was pretty much kind of 140, there was so many different tones to it. You didn't feel like you were being assaulted by content.
Nah, because everything wasn't about an 8-bar. He still had stories. He still had content, and that's the key thing, content, you know. But I think what you know, Stormzy making a decision to like to be, but do you know what though, even when as I'm sitting here saying that, he's always been ambitious like that. Dreamer's Disease was not a grime EP at all.
He's done Bieber covers, you know. It's
he's
not
done it
he's not
start,
so. Put himself in that box,
so, but you know,
all right. This is another one, actually, that I was just thinking about, lying down, just researching your life and just digging into everything.
You were lying down, set the scene a little bit better, with their clothes on at this point. Like, what was the...
Yeah, quick baby oil and tea. But anyway, so, I mean, this is more of a out there question, but see, like, when grime was created around the early 2000s, things were at a terrible time, like economically, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it was just, you know what I mean, people, as I think you've said before, like poor housing, like poor schooling, everything, and within that birthed creativity. See, like with the new kids that are coming through now, is it still the same for them? Like, is it still, are they still coming through situations like that? Or is it just very different? Because I kind of see it more as like, yeah, obviously there's still the hood, but the hoods are different. They're changing now. Yeah. Like, you know, you go to East London now, and a lot of the places that were proper hoods are not hoods anymore. They're nice areas with very expensive housing. Yeah, and that's the same around all over the place in London. You know, as I said, you still got some of the people in that around here, but you still feel like, you know, artists are, or that level of creativity is birthed through that here.
But I think that's maybe why rap came through, because I feel like maybe those environments were being found really more in South London or maybe certain parts of West. Well, like you say, East London and where grime came from has gentrified to the point of like no one can afford to live there. So all of the artists that did live there have all moved away, and that's why maybe like if you look like, you know, there's so many people coming through, have come through from south, because places like Croydon, Thornton Heath, Lewisham have still got probably a lot of issues, a lot of issues within that sort of environment. So maybe that's why, you know, Peckham, and like when Gigs came out from Peckham in 2008-2009, a long time after Grime was birthed, it was a very, very, very tough, you know, place to live, and crazy stuff was happening there. And although now we are seeing Peckham's gentrification, maybe, you know, in another five years' time, there'll be another sort of sub-genre or subculture pop up from, I don't know, somewhere in West London, or maybe it'll be Birmingham or Liverpool, because yeah, I think East London, that couldn't, Grime couldn't come out of East London now, it couldn't come out of Bow, because no one could afford to live there.
Yeah.
But if you look at South London, 6-7 Section, Suspect, you know, all these got a Stormzy, Crypt, like people that are sort of either Grime or Rap or a bit of both, or have done a bit of both, came from what maybe in 2008, 2009 was basically what South London, East London was in 2000, 2001, maybe, I don't know. I hear what you're saying, and it kind of begs the question of like how what it means for the future of the genre or the future of that sort of culture, because without pain, can you create amazing art?
I think, you know what, like now talking about it, I just feel like maybe that type of pain that we're talking about is you're going to start seeing way more outside of London, because that's where everyone's moving to. You know, people that can't afford to stay here anymore,
like,
you know, the council is saying to them, you know what, all right, boom, okay, you can't afford to stay here, that's cool, we can move you out, but we move you to Luton, or we move you to this place, or we move you to that, and then, you know, before you know it, I don't know, man, it's interesting. I just thought it was something that would cross my mind. I think it crossed my mind a little bit because I was watching a thing on One Extra just the other day, actually, with JK and Temper, like Grime MCs, who I just think are just absolutely cold. And like they give me that vibe.
They've got
again.
That energy.
Yeah, like,
but
proper.
But I suppose, like also ending, like when Grime first came through, like 9/11 had just happened. Like, you know, the London bombings were coming.
Yeah.
Politically, things were like, I don't know, we were Labour government then, right? So like things started to get cut. So like youth clubs and stuff. So what we're going to see now in another 5 years, 10 years time, where like we don't know what's happening with Brexit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, okay, yeah, people are now living in these areas, but like what's going to happen the next, but people can't maybe afford to pay their mortgage, or all of this workforce that we have from like Europe may just piss off and disappear, and we're going to be left in some kind of chaos. So so it's, times are okay now, people are eating well at the moment, but you know, things could change at any point.
What we do have as well, you know, which wasn't as readily available back then, is like it's easy to create, it's easy to put your ideas down now, and it's easy to put your ideas out, and that was, you know, whether that's a good thing or, I mean, there's pros and cons to that, you know. I think it means we probably accept mediocrity a little bit more, because there's just so much music and so much content, but you know what, out of that, I believe the real stars will shine.
Always.
You know what I mean, they will come through, and I think that is a good thing, you know. And there's always going to be people going through struggle and pain, and it's, you know, it's like London is, well, just generally everywhere is still pretty fucked up.
Yeah. What is your opinion on Grime outside of London anyway?
I think there's a lot of great stuff, you know, like you just said, JK, Safwan, Bugsy, Mez,
big up Mez.
I love Mez, Uncle Mez. I think, like, someone said to me the other day, like, it took a long time for a British audience even to accept the London, a Londoner rhyming, like, that wasn't an American voice. So it's like, now I think people are used to, and they're not only used to, like, hearing, like, Bugsy, but they actually like it.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe it's just a question of time, like it was for British MCs to finally find their voice and be accepted. Now it's just, like, London MCs, I should say, now it's, like, regionally, it's coming through as well, and I think people actually like it. I think people like, you know, the bounce and the flavour of, like,
see Mist, yeah, see Mist, right? I'm telling you, like, and I'm not, you know, I haven't spent more or less time than the rest of anyone listening to like regional MCs, but like Mist, his vibe is, it just works. You know, it's, I don't even notice his accent at all. I like it.
It's true. Yeah.
I like it.
I think that we did, like, there was a point a while ago where, you know, we dismissed it a bit. Like when you heard someone with an accent like years ago, it was just kind of like, what is
but
that like?
But now,
but that's because you two are from London. So
yeah.
The Grammy here.
Yeah. No, so yeah, you're right.
I think that's the thing. I mean, like, but like Riggs, I'm trying to think, like Wiley back in like the
yeah, early, was 2007, the early. Late, you, know, like, you see Wiley, 50. He is like the best A&R and talent finder, but he's too early. He gets on it so early that it's too early.
He was living in Manchester at a point as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he lived in Liverpool and Manchester for a bit. Yeah. He's in Manchester or Liverpool. But yeah, he it's not a new thing, but it has taken. I mean, I think actually probably Bugsy, Lisa and Bugsy are the two people that I think have really pushed through the fact that
Bugsy Malone.
Bugsy Malone. I think he just sounds so sick. Yeah. Bugsy. You know, like, you actually, not only do people not mind the accent, but they actually quite like it.
Yeah, listen, I like the accents. I'll tell you.
Yeah, I like it. As I said, there was an element years ago where I felt like, maybe not everyone, it was just odd a little bit. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think that when we now listen to, like, see, like, Giggs now has done what he's done with Drake, and now, you know, you've got like a lot of trolls in America.
Seems a perfect example,
you know what I mean? I think
they just
like,
don't get it.
They don't yet.
But then I remember when I first heard Giggs, I remember this so clearly first saying, hearing Giggs when we were in the Rewind office.
Yeah.
And I think it was Raj, one of the staff writers at the time, Raj brought in this guy, and you've got to listen to this guy, and I was like, are you serious? This is dead. Because, you know, like, you got to remember, like, this is the culture of grime and, like, speed and flow. And there's this guy with no flow rapping at, like a treakily flow. Like, I was grime, like, what is this?
I remember, like, and I
took a minute to understand.
I don't know why, but Rowley, I remember, like, we got a friend called Rowley. Yeah.
Son of a Queen.
Anyway, Son of a Queen, yeah. And he had said to me he was going to see this guy Giggs at, like, a club in Ealing. 212 or what was that club called?
I can't remember.
Anyway, I was thinking, Giggs? How's the man going to call himself Giggs? Like, I remember questioning it so much, and it's so funny to look back now and just think it's so normal, and Giggs is so hard, and if you don't get it,
how can you listen to KMT and not hear how hard Giggs? They're like,
I know.
But then I'm like, because I didn't. I knew about British accents back then, so obviously. It's like, I knew about British rappers, and so it must be for them so foreign. But he'll get there.
Of course he will.
It'll just.
And also, just bear in mind that, like, sometimes the people that speak on the internet that speak negatively always shout the loudest. Doesn't mean to say that, because I can almost promise you, if he had some shows lined up out there, it's turning up.
Yeah,
people are going out there to go and see
definitely.
Him.
Definitely.
But also, like, when you see this idea, the pieces that you get the most negative reactions on are the most popular. Yeah. Like, you can guarantee, we know we're on the right track when people start slewing. We're like, this is going to be a big piece, because that's when you know. That sort of element of trolling or hateration, or whatever you want to call it, will draw people to it. So for Giggs, it's actually a really good sign that people are like not getting it, because it means that they're listening that they're interacting. So, I mean, he probably doesn't care whether or not they get it ultimately, but he at some point, like when hip hop first started, it was all New York. They couldn't stand the LA accent.
Exactly.
South accent. Forget the Southern accent. That was a myth.
They were not interested. It took a lot for.
I've got one last question, and I'm going to start asking a few people this, actually. What do you feel like the futures back in the day is going to look like? You know, like, we talk a lot about, you know, what it was like back in the day, like, for grime MCs, or, you know, like, what was going on back in the day, music, fashion-wise. Like, what do you feel like the futures back in the day is going to look like? Is that a bit of a mad deep question?
He had this written down, and I kept reading it. The futures back in the day.
So imagine, you know, in like 15 years time or 20 years time, and you're sitting down and you're having this conversation about, like, what it was like today. Like, would be some of the things that we would mention? Like,
but I'm seeing TNs and the tracksuit.
Yeah, so, like, it's still like,
this is what was happening in 2002. This is what was going on. Like,
yeah, but you got a MacBook, you got your iPhone, you got Snap.
We used to be on the Apple team.
Well, people be laughing about Snap. So, oh my God, remember we used to Snap? Like, it'll be like Snap, Insta Stories, or like Twitter, like all those things that will be presumably dead by then.
I guess that is that is young culture, I guess, isn't it? Like, doing a Snap, but it's universal. I mean, like, I'm thinking, what would we say? You know what? You don't even particularly have to answer, because I know it's a deep one.
No, it's but an interesting question.
But it just was in my mind, you know what I mean?
It was an interesting question, because
I think that we would obviously... One thing that we would definitely look at, I know that we would definitely be talking about Giggs again. And I think that the reason why that would come up is because for so many years he was denied that lifestyle that he's living now. Mm-hmm. Do you get me? And I think that, like, we will always look back at around this time and say, rah, like, this was the time where Giggs actually managed to genuinely eat food.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll look back on this time as like a very pivotal point in terms of where things either went really right or things went really wrong. I mean, hopefully it's the first version, but you know, if I look back at 2009, 2008, whatever, that was, things both went right and wrong. Ultimately, it wasn't great for the scene. You know, for some people it was really right and they made the right decision, and, but ultimately it kind of killed what existed. So now I feel we're in a really similar place. We've got so much success and so much attention and so much hype. It kind of, it depends now what's going to happen in the next couple of years as to will determine whether or not this was ultimately a positive move for the scene.
I hope though, and I will say that we had to go through what happened in 08.
Exactly, and 09, 10, lessons have been learnt.
I think that, you know, people will just stay true. Just stay true and make your music sustainable. Like, don't tailor it to a platform that hasn't been supporting you and is now going to support you for a moment just to jump back off. That was the problem, you know. You know, and I think people are doing that. I think, you know, the sketches and the stories and the gigs and whatever.
Making music on your terms and the way you want to make it.
You know what? It's like, it's the streaming, the platforms, right? This is the key difference, that radio being the key gatekeeper back in the day, they had room to break one or two black artists or whatever, right? But streaming platform, they want to break as many artists from as many genres as they possibly can. So it's a completely different thing, you know?
And back then you had like Radio 1 and NME pretty much ruled everything.
Right.
So, you know, it's a lot more, it's a democratic playing field right now. You don't need to necessarily be signed. You know, you don't have to be on Radio 1 when you got radar.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to rely on the old system anymore. You can create your own system. Yeah. That's why I think we've seen so much success, because people are just making up their own rules.
Exactly. Parting advice for young people trying to get into journalism?
Parting advice would be just do it because you love it. It's the same as we're talking about art with artists, you know, don't get in it for the cash, do it for the love. Don't get in to try and make friends with famous people. Like, maybe that's another unwritten rule. Don't try and make friends with people, man. That's like, you know, you can be cool with people and hang out with people and it's nice, but at the end of the day, that's you. That's, they have a life and you have your life, and they don't really interact like that.
No breading.
So yeah, no breading. Like, if you want to get into journalism, hit up people like me and Laura, JP. Like, you know, get in touch with us, and hopefully we'll be able to kind of guide you a little bit and give you advice, because I think you learn a lot from people that have gone before you. So hopefully, what I do try and do is pull other people through constantly as I go. So, you know, seek out people that are already doing it and ask them how to get on.
And is it fair to say that as a journalist, when you've written a book and graduated to author, you've clocked the game?
Done.
Is that it? Is that fair to say?
Where do I go from here?
You've just say yes, hey. Yes. Just say yes. You've clocked the game. And that's it. We're going to just leave it there. Hattie's
thank
the winner.
You so much.
She's
yeah,
beaten
won.
The big boss. She's
an
author, esteemed music writer, and grime journalist, pioneering
along
grime
with Chantel.
Journalist.
Chantel's the pioneer.
Listen,
the
Fiddy, where you at? We
and
need
the book
you too.
Is out as well still, so you can get that. Are you republishing the book again?
Yeah, we're going to do some different versions actually. We're going to do some different covers, but. Right now it's on Amazon, it's on ASOS,
You know,
it's on Urban Outfitters.
Publish, you know.
Yeah. But we're going to do some different.
All right. That was sick. Hey,
thank you for coming through.
Thank you for coming through.
Very productive.
It's been amazing.
Legends in the game, the pair of you.
Yes, that was amazing. I fully enjoyed that. And again, this is one of the reasons why I enjoy having these conversations, because you learn so much, you know. Any last words from you, Benny?
We got a show 17th of April. It's at Notting Hill Arts Club. It is the neighborhood show, but a live version, although we're not interviewing anyone. We've got Belly Scored, we've got Grim Sickers, we've got Jen, we've got My Chameleon, we've got some other special guests. Chucky's going to be hosting it.
Kanji.
I might be there, and it'll be a fun night. You can get your tickets from Dice, or hit me up on Insta or whatever, and you can find the link. All right.
Yeah, Radar Radio, welcome to the neighborhood. That was Hattie Collins. Peace. Till next week. Well, a couple of weeks anyway.
They said they're running through checks, they got no dough.